some of the things that were fighting to have entrenched the Bill of Rights. But I wonder if those who are seated at the back can come here so that I don't have to shout.
State of our struggle, when everybody is clamoring for peace in this country. That the declared administration continues to ignore the demand to disband these killers. We take this as a duty. All of us, all South Africans of goodwill, irrespective of their political allegiances or ideological direction, to stand up and be counted at this time and demand the exposure of all the people involved in the killing of Benjamin and the work of the system. I will read Becky's obituary. Becky was very, very young, born in 1969. On Friday the 15th February 1991, the death squad of the fighting rested alive for yet another Comrade Bailey in London. His death bears the hallmarks of an expert operation and of course it divides in a set of headphones for the medical instrument. A proper attempt with the structure of the 1970s, Comrade Bailey rose to become one of the outstanding leaders and workers of the student movement. He served on the National Executive of Adolfo Sanso from 1982 to 1983. Was the political education officer of SANSPO from 1984 to 1985 and was SANSPO's position chairperson from 1985 to 1986. He spent a year in prison during the state of emergency. Due to the harassment and detention by the repressive Sky apparatus, he was forced to leave Portugal, eventually moving to Greece, where he completed his studies admitted to the BAMFB at the end of 1988. Comrade Bailey was also involved in the community at the time of his death. He was the chairperson of the ANC branch in Jabulani and conducting legal investigation into the CCP activities and alleged crimes. He leaves a wife, Sipati, a 5-year-old son, Manda, his parents, 3 brothers, and a sister. We extend our heartfelt condolences to Comrade Bailey's family and friends. We condemn this brutal killing and demand that the forces which perpetrated this crime be brought to justice. May I ask you to stand up for me to apply.
It is a privilege to have the honor of being
alleged by Professor Tali. He has, to his credit, published a number of papers. I cannot even begin to list them. You can see for yourself from this, these are papers that he has published. There are more than 20. He has written as well a number of books, including Federal Appeals, Jurisdiction and Practice, as well as the famous book, Law and the Rise of Capitalism. Professor Tiger.
Social change in the South African condition could at that point be benign, as if it had no enemy. Could at that point speak simply in terms of the state as a shield, rather than as an active protector of human, social, economic, national rights. In that connection, I want to read something that I came across in an article by Professor Hugard. It's a quotation from Justice Didcot. Taking nothing away from Justice Didcot, who has been very brave in stating his principles, he says, a Bill of Rights is not a political manifesto, a political program. Primarily, it is a protective device. It is a shield, in other words, rather than a sword. It can state effectively and quite easily what may not be done. It cannot stipulate what shall be done. This assertion by Justice Didcot, I respectfully submit, is flat wrong. It is wrong because, in the first place, it has the illusion of the state in a post-transformation setting as denied. That's very easy to see how one can come to such a view. If you've been laboring and struggling against the very hostile, repressive, tyrannical state for all those years, it must seem as a kind of refreshingly dialectical view to think of a new state that you would erect as being benign. Failing to recognize that the exercise of state power must often deal with the state's enemies. But more basically, that unless the state actively takes steps to promote certain values and goals, the system of social relations which is already in place will see to it those goals cannot be achieved. Now, that's a highfalutin way of saying something that I think is pretty simple. Let's take the most basic political right we can imagine. That is the freedom of speech. In the United States, the freedom of speech exists. We have a Bill of Rights, and the first article of the Bill of Rights says that Congress shall make no law, etc., etc., abridging the freedom of speech. The problem is that the freedom of speech has been defined, given the system of social relations in the United States, as the right of any person who can afford to own a newspaper or a television station or a printing press to get their ideas out into the public. The Supreme Court of the United States has gone so far as to say that the freedom of speech includes the unqualified right to contribute to political campaigns. Money, that is. That is the unqualified right of people who have a great amount of money to buy up as much television time as they want to get their political message across. And that for the state to interfere with the exercise of that right to spend money to make speech is a violation of the First Amendment, so that those without money can effectively be cut off from the instruments of mass communication. The benign state that says that the right of speech is a neutral right that prohibits people from interfering is expressed in a concrete social circumstance, the circumstance of the private ownership of the means of production. And if the means of production and exchange include the means of dissemination of ideas, a neutral benign state-type principle simply reinforces the power of the reactionary over access to the instruments by which public opinion is shaped. So therefore, I reject, on those grounds, the myth of the benign state and the myth that neutral principles that simply forbid the state from acting in certain ways are adequate to carry into being the ambitious and entirely proper set of demands that have been formulated over the decades of this struggle and are now being presented for consideration and embodiment in a post-apartheid constitution. But we needn't dwell in the present in order to see the point that I'm trying to make. Without apology, I'd like to turn to the past for a little bit. I recognize that that's a dangerous undertaking. It's always dangerous for lawyers to start talking about precedent. Because precedent in the hands of lawyers is, as Marx taught us, the means by which the infamy of today is justified by the infamy of yesterday. As law shows its a posteriori to the people, as God to his servant Moses. Well, properly understood, however, the lessons of history can tell us something. They can tell us certainly, as Marx also commented, that those who do not understand history are condemned to repeat. Everybody knows that's true. I teach in a law school. I teach civil procedure. I tell my students, those who do not understand civil procedure are condemned to repeat it. But and the same lesson for Americans, it can be seen in our social attitude very well. Properly understood also, history tells us that there are some forms, some attitudes, some aspirations that have been built up over time, and that a state that takes it, its place after a social transformation must honor and respect old attitudes, provided that they do not in other ways interfere with the state's central objectives. The failure of post-revolutionary movements to take account of old attitudes and the attempt to eradicate them has in many cases resulted in a great deal of unnecessary suffering. When I talk this way, I want to make it also clear that none of us, I think, and I only speak for myself, I certainly can predict the future course of events. I think I understand the theory of history that permits seeing a little ways into the future, but none of us in the process of drafting a constitution should fall prey to the thing that we do in our personal lives of wanting to live forever. Well, how do we know that we want to live forever? I'm 50 years old and have three children. I know I want to live forever because I'm always trying to get my children to make up to the things that I didn't get done and to impose my will on them on into the future when I know that in the first place it's futile and the second place is wrong. So as lawyers and as constitution makers and as thinkers, we ought to avoid the temptation to want to live forever in that sense. We can see as far ahead as our circumstances permit, and surely we ought to make the changes that are demanded for the moment. But let's take a look at the past. How is it that the Anglo-Saxon model constitution that is proposed by Justice Didcot as an example for us got to be made? What was it that happened along the road, and how do those things teach us that Justice Didcot would have been right had he spoken 200 years ago, but surely is not right if he speaks today? The English transformation from feudalism to capitalism can be traced a long ways back, but we don't have that much time, and I can see everybody looking at their watches. If I started back in 1200 or something, because the statute quiet and Torres and all those other things they bore you with in the property court. Now let's take a look at the coming to power of Henry VIII. Henry VIII was a magnificent king. Plays have been written, portraits have been painted. Had there been photographers in those days, they would have needed a wide-angle lens to get a picture of his weight and his rank. He was fat. He had an eye for women. He always said to his wives what we wish the lecturers would say to us on dull evenings: "Don't worry, I'm here. I'll keep you alone." Henry VIII also did something else that was fairly important. You may remember his titanic struggle with Sir Thomas More, his Lord Chancellor. The play A Man for All Seasons was written about it, and Thomas More's example has been cited as an example of courage. Courage because More confronted Henry VIII about matters of state. But what was the true confrontation between Thomas More and Henry VIII? We saw what the true confrontation was when we looked at Henry's order to seize the land of all the monasteries, all the churches in England. Why was that done, and in whose interest was it done? It was done because Henry needed the money. That was the first thing. And the properties immediately after being seized passed into the hands of the English bankers and the foreign bankers who had been paying Henry's bills all those years. But were those lands simply stately buildings filled with Bibles and monks going about their business? Were those lands simply a picture postcard verdant English hills? No, indeed. Those were the lands upon which the English peasantry had customarily exercised its rights to pasture their cattle, to raise crops, and to feed their families by an appropriation of a larger share of the agricultural production than they could possibly have managed to obtain by the tilling of what little plots they might have had the exclusive right to till. The purpose of the confiscation of the monasteries was to destroy the customary rights of the peasantry on the land. You might say to yourself, well, how in the world was that done? There are records. We know exactly how it was done. It was done brutally, it was done speedily, and it was done almost efficiently. I say almost because in the 1720s, it was necessary to drive the remaining peasants who existed by customary forms of tenure off their land in some events that I'll get to in a moment. There is, Tawney recites in his book one of those notable eviction scenes in which a peasant is being driven off land that he was occupying under right of custom. Know ye not, he said, they say that the king's grace has pulled down all the houses of the fat abbots, and now has come the time when ye three men of the city shall pull down the huts of such wretches as ye be. But what did the state say about what it was doing? Did it announce that it was engaged upon an unprecedented land grab? No. It declared that it was protecting the neutral right of property. The city bankers had bought the land. Having bought the land, they must have the right of property. The right of property, the civil law students who read Grotius and all that other stuff that they make you read would know, consists of a relationship called dominium between a person, persona, and a thing, res. The relationship of dominium between the person and the thing is by its nature absolute. Isn't that what they teach in property? I think that's what they teach in both the civil law and common law systems. Stated in that way, it's a neutral principle. But the statement of the norm in that form, neutral and absolute, excludes the customary rights of the peasantry, which cannot be, were not, and Henry, you should not have been recognized in any formal legal way. So the assertion of a neutral norm about property resulted in the wholesale dislocation of the peasantry. Later on in the 1720s, the notorious Black Acts, which were a mechanism for driving the remaining part of the customary peasantry off the land, brought the criminal law to bear on those who wanted to exercise their customary rights. This pattern, the pattern of using neutral principles about property law to deprive people of their customary tenure, and thereby reduce them either to the point of killing the small plots they had so that they could not produce an economic surplus, or, and in the 1720s this was a goal that was more manifest, making them into candidates for joining either the urban or agricultural proletariat, is an important but often forgotten chapter in English history. So when we look back, we see that the origins of a neutral norm of property are not themselves neutral. I give you a second example. The English Revolution, the 1640s, was designed to do away with the prerogatives of the king. And it was that revolution that abolished most of the prerogative courts that the king had established, whose judges served at His Majesty's pleasure. There were a number of exceptions to that abolition of the prerogative courts. One of them was the maintenance of the Court of Equities, which played a vital role in the administration of English law, tangible and intangible property. But the most significant was that principles of criminal law, which had been forged in the infamous Court of Star Chamber, were also maintained. The Court of Star Chamber had been the principal means by which blasphemy, heresy, and political dissent were punished. The devices so familiar to criminal law students in any Anglo-English-based legal system, conspiracy, attempt, and other inchoate type offenses, had their origins in the Court of Star Chamber. When I first sat down to read about the criminal law of South Africa, I was amazed not at how different it is from the English and American system, but how much the similarities are there. In the process of a fundamental social transformation in which human rights were proclaimed, the state retained these instruments, the law of conspiracy, the power to punish people who were engaged in political dissent based merely upon their associating and agreeing together. And having preserved that most important weapon, it lay always ready to hand. And no one should be fooled that the fact that it is not exercised under particular circumstances means that it could not again be taken up by the state and put to full use.
If the ownership of the means of production and exchange are in private hands,
The contract norm is not neutral under such circumstances either. And the principles of criminal law, and I won't bore you with a long excursus on the origins of conspiracy, stand ready to hand to be enforced against people who begin to doubt the validity of those norms. I'd like to put that aside for a minute, my analysis of these private law functions, and pick up that thread later, because there's one other thing that I'd like to do before I come to some conclusions here. Many, many people have pointed to the Bill of Rights in the United States as a document that's worthy of emulation. And certainly it is true, for reasons that I'll go into tomorrow's discussion in some more detail, that those of us who are involved as advocates at the bar are vitally concerned that the rights enumerated in that Bill of Rights be protected to the maximum extent possible. And I have yielded to no one. Indeed, I have often been involved in debates about this issue. I've yielded to no one in my view that it is important to make sure that these rights are kept. It is important because it is the duty of the advocate to see that the regime keeps whatever promises it makes to the people about rights, however few and however inadequate those promises may be. But South Africa is at a time when there is this unparalleled opportunity to draft something new, to draft a Bill of Rights and a Constitution that speak to the terms as they exist today. What is the background of the American Bill of Rights? The American Bill of Rights was adopted some 2 years after the American Constitution itself. It was adopted principally because there was substantial opposition to the Constitution in a number of American states, most particularly Virginia. And the yeoman lawyers, philosophers, and farmers of Virginia stood up and said that the Constitution would be a terrible and inadequate document unless it made a detailed provision for the protection of certain enumerated rights along what Justice Didcot has called the Anglo-Saxon model. Who were the Virginia farmers and lawyers who stood up and made these speeches? Patrick Henry, John Marshall, Thomas Jefferson. We know some of their names. But no, who were they? We know one thing, though. They all owned slaves. At the moment that they stood to make these speeches, their entire economic well-being rested upon the appropriation of the economic surplus from a slave economy. And the body of the American Constitution itself contained concessions to slave owners. So that whatever rights it was that they wanted to state in this benign and neutral way did not extend to the black Americans who were regarded as a form of property. Now, it was peculiar. If you had the opportunity to walk up to Thomas Jefferson on the street and ask him, "Tom, what the hell were you thinking about? Tom, you made all these speeches in the Virginia Constitutional Assembly, and yet you went home at night and your plantation being tilled by slaves. What were you thinking about?" One doesn't know what he would have answered. But I think that he would have spoken in terms that would be familiar to anyone who has read Hegel's essay on slavery. Jefferson's definition of himself as a free yeoman, able to participate in the political process in terms that were reminiscent of Athens and its assembly, required, as a matter of self-definition, that he be able to appropriate some of the economic surplus from somewhere. The very image of the yeoman farmer in the southern part of the United States in 1791 was tied up with the notion that the yeoman farmer's freedom to participate in public affairs rested upon the institution of slavery. That indissoluble connection required war in American history to break. In reading, rereading Hegel's essay on slavery recently and some articles about it, I was struck by what I found to be the similarities between the ideology of the American slave owners and the ideology of a great part of the white South African ruling class. This is a class that has defined itself by virtue of its ability to extract an extraordinary amount of surplus value from a subjugated black majority. And that, it seems to me, is an important political truth. It is important at least for the following reasons. First, these parliamentary institutions that have been erected have been built upon that precept. Second, because the white majority, the white minority, excuse me, in South Africa, because the white minority has been learning, has listened to all of the words, read all of the books about legality, they have succeeded in trivializing, marginalizing, and discrediting the ordinary institutions of judicial review. I live a great part of my life in the criminal courts of the United States. I have not lived very many days or been very many days in the criminal courts in South Africa. But I have a perception. I have a perception of a country in which 85% of the cases involving serious charges are prosecuted to judgment without the accused being represented by counsel. And I ask you not exactly what kind of a trial is that, but I also ask you, what do the mass of people think about a judicial institution that condemns someone to a lengthy term of penal servitude without respecting the most ordinary of the rights that that person is said to possess? What can people think about a judicial system that was simply a cover for the wholesale appropriation of such lands as the majority of South Africans had the right to occupy? When you think about the process of building the Constitution, it's necessary, it seems to me, to confront the reality that Anglo-Saxon-type institutional structures come into play bearing a heavy burden of skepticism, cynicism, and perhaps outright disregard. Today, some of those issues, the issues involving the narratives of Americans' experience with chattel slavery, are still being fought out. Even after the Civil War in the United States, even after the Civil War, the most that was offered to the former slaves was the vision of freedom based upon the neutral application, neutral in quotes, I think, by now, of the principles of property, contract, criminal law. That is to say, the former slaves would have the right to sell their labor or to farm some land if they could find it, to enter into the sort of free relationships of contract, but free recognizing that they confronted an economic system in which economic power was wielded by that same group of people who had formerly held them in slavery. The American Constitution was amended after the Civil War. It was amended to provide that there should be equal protection of the law. It was amended to formally abolish slavery. But I want to focus on that American provision, equal protection of the law. I think I know what that meant. Those words, equal protection of the laws, were purchased at an enormous price in human blood. President Abraham Lincoln said shortly before his assassination that without the respecting of those rights, all that would have been in vain. The accession of the former rebel states to those constitutional provisions was required as a condition of their re-entering the Union. Anyone who spends the slightest moment studying the American history, first the adoption of the Constitution with its recognition of slavery, Then Frederick Douglass's attempt to get the Constitution interpreted, even as it's good, to abolish slavery. Then the benign assurance by justices of the Supreme Court of the United States that a judicial reaffirmation of slavery would solve the problem. And finally, then the Civil War. Anybody who reads that knows that equal protection of the law doesn't mean anything unless it means that the ravages in human terms committed by the institution of chattel slavery and all of their remnants would have to be eradicated. And yet today, we have conservative reactionary political figures and judges who read the words of that classic Anglo-Saxon text, the Constitution in neutral principles, the Constitution as a shield, not a sword, it doesn't fit God's word, and say equal protection of the laws. Well, that means that if you should give a preference to a black applicant for a job as a means of atoning for past discrimination, that you have denied white people the equal protection of the law. And therefore, you're forbidden by the Constitution to do that. Or you take the patent. Well, I'll tell you, for two terrible days, it almost did 2 months ago, in a way that I was personally involved.